Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
As always, thank you to our subscribers listening on Tuesday for being paying members and helping to keep this thing afloat. Look, yes, you get access to the bonus episodes. Yes, you get to comment on all the stories. And yes, you get to partake in the chat. But really, your biggest prize is knowing that in this intro, I am personally speaking to each and every one of you, my beautiful subscribers, who I treasure more than the sun itself every week. So if you want that warm, fuzzy feeling inside you, you go become a paying member. All right. And now on to controversies and non-controversies. We got a doozy this week as Christopher Nolan has found himself in the crosshairs of the alt-right for daring to cast black people in The Odyssey and over rumors, probably completely false rumors, we'll get to that in a second, that Elliot Page would be playing Achilles in the film. Now, Christopher Nolan is no stranger to idiotic controversy swirling around his movies. Some of those came in the kind of standard form of superhero casting freakouts, right? As when Heath Ledger was chosen to play the Joker in The Dark Knight. You people may be too young to remember the Heath Ledger wars. But as a veteran of both the Heath Ledger wars and the Michael Keaton wars in the original Batman, let me tell you, they get pretty ridiculous. Both that movie and its sequel were also decried as borderline fascist, if not evil masterpieces, as Salon described The Dark Knight Rises. Interstellar was condemned as a work of climate denial because no character turned to the screen and said, the world is ending because of man-made climate change, and that's bad, and we should not have man-made climate change. Previous historical epics, Dunkirk and Oppenheimer, were accused of whitewashing history because they didn't invent black characters to have played out key roles in these historical events. And when Tenet came out, some critics literally refused to review the film and then accused Nolan of trying to get people killed by releasing a movie during COVID. What's interesting about this latest kerfuffle is that all the rest of those freakouts were left-coded. I think it's fair to say those were all left-liberal-coded. This is right-coded. This is a right-conservative-coded thing. It's led by Elon Musk and his coterie of dipshits on Twitter. People lost their mind about Lupita Nyong'o being cast as Helen of Troy and her murderous sister, I'm going to botch this.
Clytemnestra.
Clytemnestra. I just, the M and the N sound there, I don't like it. Because, as we all know, if Zeus seduces the queen of Sparta while in the form of a swan, and then Helen is born from an egg that is a result of that union, the woman that springs from that egg will absolutely positively have to be white. That's just a fact. That's science. I don't make up science, folks. I just report the facts. The Elliot Page thing is more interesting in a certain way. Page, of course, worked with Nolan back when he was Ellen Page. He played Ariadne in Inception. In the trailer, we see Elliot Page playing what appears to be a shade in the underworld. Now, as we've discussed in our Odyssey book club, Achilles does, in fact, show up here. Interestingly, by the way, so does Ariadne, which neither here nor there. But given the line that we hear Page read, it seems more likely that the character being portrayed is either the prophet Tiresias or Elpenor, who is one of Odysseus's shipmates who breaks his neck after drunkenly falling off a roof on Circe's island. But even if Page were playing Achilles, I don't think it's some insane slight or like woke exaggeration to suggest that the withered ghost of Achilles might look like Page's wiry, drunken form. Anyway, Musk thundered about his about this to his domain of idiots, screaming about Nolan needing to race swap the casting in order to win Oscars. This, in and of itself, is idiotic. Nolan won, I think, what was it, seven Oscars for the virtually all-white Oppenheimer. And as Variety noted, the newish Oscar rules about inclusion wouldn't have disqualified any Best Picture winner in history from winning. Now, this leads to a separate question about why the rules exist and also kind of awkwardly confirms a longstanding conservative argument about affirmative action, which is that it casts doubt on the qualifications of those who even theoretically might have received it. But that's a cons and nons for another day. Alyssa, have you decided to boycott the Odyssey? Is the book club over? Are we done with book club? Because it's too woke. Odyssey too woke. Not doing it anymore.
We've done a lot of cons and nons in the course of this podcast. We've been doing this for more than 6 years. This is the stupidest fucking controversy I have come across in the history of this podcast. First of all, because
I find that hard to believe. I can find a stupider controversy than this one.
No, I think this one's real dumb. First, because the people who are throwing temper tantrums are telling on themselves, right? I mean, it is the most nakedly like Lupita Nyong'o cannot possibly be the hottest woman in the world because she's black, right? Like, it's not even subtext. It's like, it is just straight up like, Helen of Troy is white. The hottest woman in the world has to be white, right? It's like the, it is so just blatant and absurd. Second, like, none of these people have any ideas or any knowledge whatsoever of the role that Helen plays in the Odyssey, which is actually fascinating. And it's something I wrote about in, I've written about a couple of times as we've been reading the book. But part of what is fascinating about Helen in the Odyssey is that she functions as a kind of parallel to Odysseus, right? She is someone who is effectively forced to leave home, right? Like, it's not like she is some, you know, seductress flitting around the Mediterranean. She is selected as a prize, like one of my kids at a carnival fair, after, you know, Paris like wins the golden apple and he gets to pick the fairest woman in the world as his wife. And he meanders up to the, you know, Homeric equivalent of the carnival state sedan and is like, I want that stuffy, except that stuffy is someone else's wife. And the gods, because the Greek gods are the Greek gods, are like, sure, run off with her, take her to Troy. And if you read the Iliad, she spends much of the Iliad sort of wanting to commit suicide, being distraught about the fact that her beauty has been the cause of this horrible war. I mean, she essentially spends the whole Iliad being kidnapped and then having post-traumatic stress disorder. And so in the Odyssey, she has made it home before Odysseus does. She is at home with her original husband, Menelaus. She is obviously, in the text, sort of happy to be there. She is restored to her rightful role. She's restored to the relationship itself. Menelaus has like clearly forgiven her for anything that might have happened during their 10 years apart. And she is this, you know, she is this sort of living argument that being at home and being sort of in your proper role in a good marriage is this sort of guarantor of, you know, dignity and decency and worth, right? She, you know, she helps fill in the story for Telemachus about what has happened during the Trojan War. You know, she is the person who sort of tells us the story of the Trojan horse. She, you know, she sees it pulled into Troy. She sort of walks around the horse, like calling out for the soldiers inside in the voices of their husbands. But she is, you know, she is a symbol of what Odysseus will be again, his own way, when he comes home. And not just when he comes back to Ithaca, but when he settles back into his marriage, when he, you know, gains control of his household again. Like, she is sort of in some ways the clearest parallel of someone who, you know, has been buffeted by the gods in this very direct way and, you know, taken out of her home, of her role. And one of the things that's really lovely in the first two thirds of the Odyssey is kind of seeing her, you know, because you've seen her in the Iliad, you know, distraught, discombobulated, suicidal. And the last we see of her in the Odyssey is her presenting this robe to Telemachus that she has made, you know, that's part of her job and part of, you know, sort of the archetypal job of these Greek wives is weaving for their families. She presents him with this robe that he will give to his own bride, that he'll use to sort of establish his own family, right? And so Helen's role in the Odyssey is not to be a sex object, right? She is to be sort of an archetypal wife, but also a parallel to our hero, someone who has survived trauma and returned home and is now setting up Telemachus to play his own role in his household someday, right? And the idea that the most important thing is that she's hot is just like, this is the most illiterate, ignorant, foolish, self-revealing nonsense, right? I mean, this is 20 years after she's the hottest woman in the world. Like, there is just no clear sort of public discourse in quite some time. That's just a bunch of men being like, the only possible narrative of this woman is to be hot for my consumption. And like, the only way for her to be hot for my consumption is for her to be like a very specific kind of white lady. And it just, how can you possibly position yourself as a defender of Western culture and be this obviously disengaged with a text? It makes me crazy, right? It's like flames on the side of my face stuff. But also just like read the Odyssey. It's so good. And it's so much richer than this version of it that is being debated on social media that I despise.
It is also just like, it is very obvious how few people who are commenting on this have ever actually read it or have read it recently enough to remember certain things. Like there was this one, like one tweet that had gone viral, like Christopher Nolan is making Greece itself look ugly. Look at how much mist there is in this shot of Odysseus with Athena. It's like literally, the text. It's like literally the text of the Odyssey is she shrouds everything with mist, so he is confused and then can change his appearance, blah, blah, blah. The Elliot Page thing is also interesting because it is one of these things where this all spawned, as best as I can tell, from a ridiculous clickbait IGN listicle where they have Elliot Page Achilles rumored, and it just got taken for fact after that, which is, again, it's one of these things where, like, if you actually read, the section of the Odyssey that Achilles appears in, what Elliot Page is saying in this snippet from the trailer bears no relation to what Achilles said or would say. Maybe it is Achilles. I don't know.
No, it's very strange, right? Especially, and I should note that IMDb has been very slow to update with the characters that actors are playing in this movie. And I imagine in some cases, like maybe that's sort of deliberate, part of the publicity strategy. But like, there is no obvious confirmation of this. And there are a number of characters, as Sunny said, that Paige could be playing. In fact, the prophet Tiresias in Greek myth is literally transformed into a woman for a period of years and, you know, by the gods and is eventually transformed back, right? I mean, if Paige is playing Tiresias, there's actually something sort of witty and interesting in that choice. But we don't know. Like, you know, how you can be so like, we're the people who care about facts and reasons. Like, we have been given the vapors by like an IGN listicle. What on earth, right? Like, and they say that women are the feminized and hysterical species. For the love of God, like, these people are idiots.
Peter, do you think they are idiots, or do they have good, strong, solid points that they're making here with their outrage?
Definitely don't have good, strong, solid points. I'm going to actually say something maybe a little controversial. It's possible in my mind that all of the casting decisions that are being criticized are in fact bad casting decisions. And guess what? We have no idea because we haven't seen the movie. And we'll find out if any of these people are any good in any of these roles when we see the movie. And until then, we don't know. We don't even know which roles they're playing in some cases because we haven't seen the movie. Once you've seen the movie, you can complain about the movie. That's how movie complaining works. Otherwise,
the laws of movie,
you can't complain,
yes,
about the movie.
Well, that's cuck talk right there, first of all. But second of all, I can criticize anything I want for any reason I want. Peter, this is Twitter.
No, free speech does not work like that. We changed it.
No.
We put a specific carve out in the First Amendment so that you can't complain about movies until you've seen the movie. This is actually long-standing gripe of mine is there should not be significant controversies about the content of a film that essentially no one has seen. And this happens all the time. This happens all the time. In particular, I think, you know, you mentioned a bunch of, in fact, quite dumb left-coded controversies about Christopher Nolan. Pretty much all of those happened. Yeah, okay. I guess the casting of Heath Ledger as the Joker might be an exception here, but a lot of them were kind of based on having seen the movie, like when the movie came out, right? And people could argue about it and they were dumb.
but you could argue about it, at least because you could go see the movie in the theater this week.
Not the Tenet one where they're Christopher Nolan's murdering people.
but they weren't arguing that the movie was bad exactly. They were arguing that Christopher Nolan's marketing push was bad, which, I saw that movie in a theater. I was very happy to do so. I did not. In any case, these are the rules. You got to watch the movie if you want to complain about the movie. You got to read the book if you want to write a book review.
And if you want to tell me that you care a lot about the Western canon, like show any familiarity with, not even passion for classical literature, but like, look, I'm a weird freak, right? Like, I acknowledge that it is a strange thing to be.
You're the normal one on this pod.
I mean, it's a little weird to be reading two translations of the Odyssey simultaneously, right? Like, that's some extra Hermione Granger shit. I completely understand that. But, like, I love the Odyssey. Like, I love the Iliad. I attempted to teach myself Homeric Greek at one point, right? And, like, the just sort of the contempt defenders of Western civilization have for the things that they claim to be defending drives me insane. It's just like, I think it's actually just a really ugly tendency to claim that you are the defender of texts that like, I'm not sure I'm not sure that if Elon Musk showed up and was like, I have read the Odyssey, that I would believe him, right? Like, just not sure I would believe it. I'm not sure like 99% of these people have read the poetry or, you know, care about the circumstances under which it was codified or anything. If you want to argue about movies, see the movie. If you want to have strong feelings about the Western canon, read the Western canon. Like, all this stuff is so much richer and stranger than the school version of it that we get. And it is so disrespectful to it to refuse to engage with it. It just makes me nuts.
Okay, I'm not quite Steelman, but let me make the best argument, I think, for some of the annoyance here, all right? Like set aside the outrage. We have for the last 10 years or so been mired in endless series of like controversies over whitewashing of movies, right? Of race swapping, like the insane thing about Scarlett Johansson and Ghost in the Shell. I could do a whole segment on that because I thought it was
the controversy over her casting was stupid and the movie was bad.
The movie was good, first of all, and she was great in it. But the argument here is, well, the turnabout is fair play. If you're going to spend a decade whinging about this sort of thing and you're going to try and, you know, you would never cast a white person as the queen in that movie about the African kingdom, right? What was that that came out a couple years ago? I can't even remember. There are roles you would never cast. You would never put a white person in that role. So it's outrageous that you would put an African looking woman in this role of the Greek, not quite demigoddess Helen. And like,
also revealing an ignorant. Can I like also revealing both an ignorance of the text and the ancient Mediterranean, right? Like, you know, Menelaus is specifically talking about like getting blown off course and spending a couple years getting rich in Egypt. There are mentions of sort of a mythical Ethiopia. My mother-in-law is Sicilian, but she's also part Nigerian because the Mediterranean was, you know, multi-ethnic and this center of trade in a way that, you know, like this is not new historiography. Like 23andMe has taught us this. It's a complicated place.
You're thinking of the Woman King, by the way, Sonny.
The Woman King. Also Thank you. That's
also the name of a great Iron and Wine album.
You would never cast Diane Kruger as the head of the Woman King tribe, would you? So why? And I look. And again, this is all very silly. In part because now I'm gonna steel man against my steel man. This it's such a dumb counter. Aside from like scratching a culture war itch that these folks really want to scratch, because again, like Helen, kind of mythical. Like we don't know for 100% sure if Helen existed. We certainly think she probably wasn't born of a swan having sex with a lady and she sprang from an egg. That probably didn't happen. So I feel like you get a little bit of leeway. You can cast that pretty much any way you want. Also, I don't know.
Also reasonably sure that Odysseus was not like a blue collar Boston guy, like who makes movies with his best friend.
Will Hunting makes a perfect Odysseus. He is wily, just like Will Hunting himself. How do you like
them apples? Also, has experienced PTSD. I don't know.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not his fault. It's not his fault. You got Telemachus there just holding his hand saying, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. All right. Okay. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Christopher Nolan cast a black woman and a trans man in The Odyssey, Alyssa?
I sentence all of these people to read both Fagles, Fitzgerald, and Wilson and come back to me when they have remedied their own ignorance.
Peter.
I'm a little bit behind in The Odyssey, and I switched to only reading the Wilson translation, so maybe I shouldn't even comment here. Maybe I should wait till I'm done with it, and then I'll have some thoughts. No, it's dumb.
I am up to where we are in the reread, and I will say it's a non-troversy. This whole thing is dumb. It's dumb, and people are dumb. All right. Stop being dumb, people. Make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for a special bonus episode on the death of American cool, the cultural soft power that made America the envy of the world. Is it because we spent all of our time fighting about whether or not a black lady can be Helen? Maybe. It's probably not unrelated. And now on to the main event. In the Gray. Wait, what? What is In the Gray? I can actually hear you saying this in your, what the fuck? What are they reviewing? Anyway, there's a new Guy Ritchie movie out. It stars Henry Cavill and Jake Gyllenhaal. It was out this weekend. No one seems to know about it. Very few people went to go see it. I think it grossed like $2 or $3 million. Now, look,
We almost forgot that it was coming out.
What's that?
We almost forgot that it was coming out. We were like, nothing's coming out this weekend. And then
you guys
one of you
did.
I was like,
no, there's a new Guy Ritchie because yeah. I am a Guy Ritchie completist. I think I've seen all of his movies, and in his recent run of 8 movies in the last 7 years, which I think is what we're at, 2 or 3 of those have made my top 10. So I was well aware there was a new Guy Ritchie movie coming out. Thank you very much. That certainly was not the case for everybody. Obviously, the film did not do particularly well. But is it worth your time to check out? It depends. Depends on your tolerance level for lesser Guy Ritchie, because this is definitely lesser Guy Ritchie. It's the first hour or so is like a straight up exposition dump for like an hour. It's just a voiceover narration by Aiza Gonzalez, who is playing this character Rachel. She's explaining how she came to be the one who was trying to recover $1 billion for a private equity firm that employs Bobby, who's played by Rosamund Pike, from international businessman Salazar, Carlos Bardem. She's got the aid of Bronco, Jake Gyllenhaal, and Sid, Henry Cavill, to get all this money back. How are they going to do it? They're going to use legal tricks. They're going to employ a small mercenary army. This is how you do it. This is how you get your money back from Salazar. I have a pretty high tolerance for this sort of thing. The dialogue here at least kind of faints towards snappiness. I enjoy seeing these actors work. I like how they're dressed. Say what you will about Guy Ritchie, but the man knows clothes, and everyone in this picture is like 30% more stylish than they need to be. It's the sort of film where, for no reason whatsoever, towards the beginning, we get a step-by-step instructions as to how to make a cocktail that is being enjoyed by Rachel. And then on-screen translations, we get like a list. We get like a written list on the screen that's just translations of munitions from Ritchie Patter into their actual names. Turns out butt plug means RPG rocket. Who knew? Who knew? It's edited as snappily as you can edit a 1 hour long exposition dump. But this really is like an hour of talking. Then there's a brief action sequence, and then there's like 10 more minutes of talking, and then there's a 20 minute action sequence. That's the movie. That's the whole movie. It's very oddly structured. It's a very oddly structured movie is what I'm saying here. And one gets the sense that the 100 minutes or so that remain on screen were trimmed down from something denser, something maybe even more meaningful. You know, the bass or cello or whatever it is that Christopher Benstead plays. He does the score here. It calls to mind the work he did on Wrath of Man or The Covenant. And when I heard it, I was like, ooh, oh, this is interesting. I was expecting like a snappy, you know, something more like The Gentleman or even The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. But I instead, what we got is not that. It's like, I don't know. This was sitting on the shelf for a couple of years while a producer distributor Black Bear tried to figure out what to do with it. And I would love to see the original incarnation of this movie, or at least like what the original script looked like, because what we got is, I think, probably a little bit different. I don't know. Maybe in the original version of this film, the relationships were more than sketches. Maybe we would come to understand why there's antagonism between Rachel and Bobby. Maybe we get a sense of like the role private equity plays in the original version of this movie. There's actually a scene towards the beginning where Henry Cavill and Jake Gyllenhaal's character are talking about how private equity controls the world. They just give their money over to them and then they let it multiply. And that's how they you know, accumulate wealth, which is like kind of interesting, and trying to figure out where that money comes from and what they do with it. Okay, I could be talked into this being a acceptable movie premise. I don't know. We don't get any of that. We don't even know what Salazar's deal is, really. Like, Salazar, as far as we can tell, he's just a legitimate businessman. We only see him do legitimate businessman things, really.
Well, like, except for having a private army that he uses to try to assassinate multiple members of the cast of this film. Multiple characters, not the actual cast members.
Yeah, but what are they? Why does he have them? Why are they like, is he a drug dealer? Is he what's his actual like shady business that is hiding?
Because this movie gives us 50 minutes of exposition before anything happens, and they forget to tell us anything about any of these characters.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a pretty easy lay when it comes to Richie. This film is no exception. I liked it fine. I was entertained as I was sitting there. It goes down easy. Everyone on screen is very pretty. I have a hard time recommending it for anyone other than my fellow Guy Ritchie diehards. But I do have a very important question for you, Peter. This is certainly this was the thing that jumped out at you. Did the film correctly demonstrate how to make a stovetop Negroni?
Yeah, more or less. So this is an old Salvatore Calabrese drink. It's the Negroni Sfegliato, which is a Negroni that basically you move the coffee into the vermouth, as you see on screen, right? And then the coffee kind of functions in the way that Campari would normally function in a Negroni. So you have gin, sweet vermouth, and instead of bitter Campari, bitter coffee. Like, this is not a drink that I have like workshopped, so it's possible that I would have criticisms of their exact method if I'd spent a week making them every night and trying to figure them out. But yeah, this is about right from what I know of the drink. On the other hand, it's really weird to see this sequence 15 minutes or so into the movie, and it's supposed to be this jaunty sort of like fun thing, which we also get a little bit later when we go into their weapons stash, when they first get to the island. We see all of their kit that they have laid out, all of these guns and rocket launchers and different vehicles and all of this, right? And the screen sort of stops and shows us, writes it down for us. Like it's a little notebook, right? These little British people like walking around being so fun with their kit, right? And this movie kind of feels like, in some ways, it was just designed for Guy Ritchie to play with a bunch of toys. You've got those little mini helicopters. You've got those cool, like, RV, not RV, oh, those, like, four-wheeler things, those sort of super ATVs. Four-wheelers, ATVs that come into play, sort of in the practice sequence in the beginning of the film, and then again, inevitably, in the third act. You've got that cool escape boat. Also, all of these weapons, and the weapons are obviously particularly, like, specifically chosen. It's clear that in the same way that Guy Ritchie spent a lot of time on Henry Cavill's pants, which look really genuinely amazing, not just because of Henry Cavill, though it helps, but like great pants and also great guns, right? Like the guns themselves are fashionable and interesting and have different choice, right? Like different mechanisms that they, you know, sort of are deployed for different types of gunfights. And he spent a lot of time on this. And it does just sort of seem like, this movie was intended to be a lark, something sort of light and fun where all of the guys could get together and blow some stuff up and sort of play with these toys, except for the fact that there's this score. And except for the fact that the movie has the score that is incredibly kind of dark, dour, sort of suggesting of something that is much that is much less fun, that is much less jaunty than the picture that we see. There's much more like Wrath of Man, which was just, and The Gentlemen, both of which were much darker films, even though they had some of that Guy Ritchie lightness. And then, you know, and then the other thing that suggests that this movie has been heavily redone is just all of this voiceover, because this is a way that filmmakers can go and take footage that isn't working or that a producer has said you cannot release the film in this state. A thing you can do is you can basically turn what you have into a slideshow and then have the, you know, re-record a new voiceover, because going and getting more footage, right, sort of actual footage is very expensive to produce, right? Reshoots, all of this. But voiceover, it's pretty inexpensive. You know, you can do a complete voiceover in a day or two. Often the actors don't even have to go anywhere. They can do it from their home or from, you know, a studio in the city that they're in. And so this just strongly suggests to me that the movie we are seeing has maybe not very much to do, actually, with the original film. And it really shows. It doesn't work on its own, and it also often feels at odds with itself. It is surprisingly just boring. This is a boring movie. It's a little hard to follow. And again, I suspect that is because the plot that we are delivered is not the original plot, right? There's just like, what is going on here? Why do I care? It's not like you're totally confused, but it sure seems like a lot of details that aren't really going anywhere or adding up to anything. And it's just a mess. I can't recommend this, even if you are a Guy Ritchie completist. The best case I can make for this is that this is maybe a good 1:30 a.m. insomnia action movie of the kind that I've talked about on this podcast. I've watched, like, for example, a lot of Jean-Claude Van Damme movies in my life. In the past 15 years, I'm not sure I've ever seen one outside of the hours of 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. because you turn them on when you're like, I can't sleep. My brain is racing and you need something that is sort of dumb and sort of comforting to keep you company while you're trying to sleep. And it will help you go back to sleep. I could imagine falling asleep to this movie. And in fact, I believe one of our co-podcasters may have done so while watching it this weekend.
Guilty. I fell asleep during the final action sequence. I don't even know if I need to say this is in my defense, but I just had a bad night of sleep the night before and I just started nodding off.
If only this had been on Paramount Plus for you to watch at 1:30 a.m., you would have had a better night of sleep.
Yeah, maybe I would have, although it would not have prevented my children from waking me up with random needs at odd hours of the night. Although, really, you know, maybe I should try it for that. No,
Mommy, what's going on in this movie?
Yeah, there's definitely like a, are you watching a scary movie from the top of the stairs that we get a lot of the time when we're watching TV? But no, this just like, I didn't care about any of these people or any of the stakes or anything that was happening. And I just nodded off during the final action sequence because I was so tired and so disengaged. And
sequence, you've seen all the beats because the whole first hour is just them rehearsing. It's all set up for the third act, right? Which again is a thing that's kind of happened, right? Like you can imagine, like Ocean's 11 does this sort of thing extremely well. There are twists on what you expect to happen. Also, it's not the whole first hour and then a 30 minute of just sort of replaying it.
They're not twisting.
It's like you know
it's
exactly
weird.
What is going to happen.
Yeah. It's just bizarre.
It's a very weird movie because it does the same thing twice. It does you have like a kind of assault on the island, and then you have a little break, and then you have a second longer assault on the island. And it's just like, why are we back here again? Why is this happening?
And there's like some mysterious person on a red phone who's going to deliver, you know, Rosamund Pike bad news. And for some reason, she like works out on her treadmill in business attire. It's like, what? I don't understand like any of the choices that are happening, but I also can't care enough to be invested.
The thing that was interesting about this that I mentioned to you guys in our text is this is another Guy Ritchie movie that to the extent you can pull out any kind of theme, any sort of like deeper idea, it's about debts. And that's what The Gentleman is about. That's what Wrath of Man is about. That's what The Covenant is about to some degree or another. Is that there is great honor in paying your debts and there is great dishonor in not paying your debts, and that there, this is like a deep moral wrong in the Guy Ritchie universe, is that people who don't pay their debts are bad people who are making the world a bad place and deserve what's coming to them. And so, of course, the movie is mostly about the Salazar big bad, but then it is bookended with these sequences with Rosamund Pike. And when we finally get to the last one, where she is not punished in the same way that Salazar is, but kind of gets what is coming to her to some degree or another, the thing that I think that Jake Gyllenhaal says, it might have been Henry Cavill, but I think Jake Gyllenhaal says is right, is like, you have, is something about having to pay your debt, but not paying your debt, because they have found out that this big corporation, this big money corporation that she works for and represents, has not paid their debt to the Eliza Gonzalez character. And that is what makes her like really, that's what makes her sort of like the actual big villain here. And this is a theme that has come up several times in Guy Ritchie land as his movies have become darker, as his movies have become a little more serious, not just these kind of jaunty things that he made early on. And you wonder, we asked this question, actually, I think, when we saw Wrath of Man, which we all liked quite a bit. But that was a movie that was like suddenly had a dark edge we'd never quite seen from Guy Ritchie before. This movie feels like it was intended to have that dark edge, and also, once again, to be about the debt that men, or, you know, that humans owe to each other. And when people don't pay it, you're destroying like the fabric of society. You are making yourself a villain.
Yeah. There's like this whole speech towards the beginning of the film that's like, there's black and there's white and there's red and we operate in the gray, right? Like, that's where the title of this movie comes from. But except that that's not true of the film, right? Like, the film itself is like, there actually is black and white. There's like, you pay your debts or you don't pay your debts. There's not really a in between. You got to do it, or we'll send people to kill you and steal all your businesses and steal your ships and your airplanes, and we're gonna ruin you. Again, I guess illegitimate businessman. It remains to me very unclear what Salazar's whole deal is. Like, does he take investments and then just not pay them back and try to kill people? Like, I guess that's
not usually a thing that works.
It's, you don't do that. You don't get away with that more than one time. You can do that once, maybe, but that's about it. The whole thing with this film and private equity or whatever it is that Rosamund Pike's firm does, you know, they at one point they're
private
like
credit,
private credit. I don't know. At one point,
the words
Gonzalez
they use were
says,
asset management,
whatever it is. I like, you know, whatever their fund is, whatever their BlackRock sized fund is. Like, they, at one point, Isaac Gonzalez says something like, you know, they are dealing with trillions. Your 1 billion is like a hot dog stand on the corner. And like, okay, there's kind of an interesting idea here about like the size of business and even like huge businesses being treated like the little guy. Like, okay, it just is so, it's so clearly has been stripped to the very barest of bones that it almost is not, I didn't have trouble following what was happening. I just had trouble caring about what was happening because there was so little information. It was just like, what is going on here? Why are we doing this?
And it's possible. I mean, it is possible to make good movies about financial engineering, about finance, about sort of the state of the economy, right? I mean, Margin Call, Too Big to Fail. And there are potentially really interesting stories in some of the things that are happening in the economy right now in the world of private credit, right? I mean, as far as I understand it from listening to like Lots of the Money Stuff podcast, the way private credit works, and one of our regular listeners may correct me in comments for this, private credit is basically this alternative to the traditional banking system that has arisen in part because some people have so much money that they need more places to put their investments. And so you have places like BlackRock and Blue Owl that are essentially functioning as like a shadow banking system where if you have a business, you can go and get a big loan. I don't know if the terms are more or less favorable if you're business, but it's a way to get capital sort of outside of the traditional banking system. And like there's some questions about whether some of the big private credit groups have sort of marked the value of their assets correctly. Like, there are big moral questions to ask about like what happens when you have people who are doing lending and borrowing sort of outside of the regulated banking system. And you could make an interesting movie. You could even make an interesting heist movie or action movie about one of these investments. But this just, it's a very weird movie. And it's very dull. The only thing I enjoyed about it was Fisher Stevens, because I have like weird youthful memories of Fisher Stevens as the sleazy friend in Early Edition, which was the movie that which was the TV show that turned me on to Kyle Chandler before all the, you know, latecomers and Friday Night Lights. But yeah, it's just a very
strange
movie.
He's the evil
movie.
Hacker in Hackers.
Yes, he is. He's a
Fisher Stevens is an accomplished stage actor, but to me, he will always be the evil hacker from Hackers. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on In the Gray? Alyssa?
I mean, as a melatonin alternative, it's like more expensive and not as effective. So thumbs down.
Peter?
It's better than Spider-Woman.
On Madame Spider-Woman
Web.
Scale.
Madame Web. Jesus.
Oh, sorry, Madame Web. Whatever.
It's better than Madame Web, which you can tell I really liked because I can remember the name of that movie. But no,
what about Morbius?
Movie. you know, if Jake Gyllenhaal had said it's Morbin time in this movie, I would have given it a thumbs up. But sadly,
I am going to give it a very, again, hesitant thumbs up here, but it's for a very specific subset of person, which is like
for Henry Cavill's pants.
You?
A person precisely like me who just needs, you got to see all the Guy Ritchie movies. I think I've given all of his movies a thumbs up, except for maybe.
Did you see
King
the one
Arthur
he
Chab,
did
King
for
Arthur?
Streaming just directly? Did you see the Fountain of Youth?
Fountain of Youth. No, I did not. I didn't like that one very much, actually. I don't think I reviewed it fully, but I talked about it on a different podcast, and it's not very good. That is not very good, and it's so generic that, like, that could have been directed by anybody. That could have been, it's such a weird Skydance Apple TV movie. Anyway.
Good for you. Right. Good news for Sonny, though, I just want to point out here, is that he has two more movies in the can, including another one coming out in the fall.
Is that the one with Jason Statham?
It's called Wife and Dog.
I don't know.
It's got Benedict
Cumberbatch. Hopefully he's got another Statham.
I think it doesn't say it has Jason Statham in it, but I understand that he has another Statham film coming out.
That's what I'm looking for, baby. Guy Ritchie and Jason Statham, get my boys back together. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. And you can make sure to go read the Odyssey posts if you have. Those are very popular. People seem to love the Odyssey posts. We're going to have to do more book clubs in the future. But it's timely now. I feel educated because we've been doing these. And I can laugh at all of these fools, like Kevin Sorbo, who's like, dude, Greece is so gray in this picture. Ugh. Shut up, Hercules. All right, see you guys on Thursday. Okay.